Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, waking you up this morning. If you're not energized for the truth, you will be after hearing that. The Battle Hymn of the Republic from Stryper here on the Cross in the Desert. This morning we have a very special guest. She is a good friend of mine. Her name is Nazreen Mohammadi, and she is from Iran. And she's been an American-Iranian citizen here for the last, I think, about 7 years. And she lives in Los Angeles. She will shortly join us. And this morning we're going to talk about the latest deal that President Obama has constructed with the Iranian regime. We're going to get her reactions to that. But we're also going to talk about her late brother. That is Akbar Mohammadi, who died from his injuries in Evin prison 9 years ago this July. And it is a very, very painful thing for Nazreen to talk about. But in light of what's happened here just recently with the framework being arranged for this nuclear Holocaust disaster, we're going to get Nazreen's thoughts on this. And as always, I always appreciate your thoughts and your comments in the chat room today. Hopefully there will be Mary and Vito. Thank you all for coming this morning and taking out of your busy life to listen to The Cross in the Desert. It is so much appreciated. I love every one of you. I know that you sacrifice some of your valuable time. And most of you do listen on the archives, and that's fine. But thank you for supporting my dear friends in Iran. Akbar Mohammadi is Nazreen's late brother. He is featured in my current book, The Cross in the Desert, Speaking Hope and Freedom to Iran. And he was an amazingly very courageous individual, inspired by the likes of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Nazreen will, of course, share that with us today. And I dedicated part of my book to him. He was a martyr for peace and freedom. He actually wrote a poem shortly before his demise, and we'll do that a little bit later. Right now, I want to welcome to The Cross in the Desert my good friend from Los Angeles, Nazreen Mohammadi. Good morning, Nazreen Mohammadi, and welcome to The Cross in the Desert.
Good morning, dear Randy, and thank you so much for having me in your program.
I know it's early there in Los Angeles. I thank you so much for spending this time with me this morning. You are currently pursuing a Ph. degree in leadership. You're also a human rights activist, and you're the author of the book I have in my hand here, Ideas and Lashes, which is the prison diary of your dear late brother, Akbar Mohammadi. Nazreen, as you look at what's happened in the last week and you see President Obama sitting across, if you will, from the table with the Iranian regime that murdered your brother, Akbar, in Evin prison, do you feel betrayed by your president?
Of course, I feel betrayed. There have been several instances that President Obama could have made historical moment by helping Iranian people, but unfortunately, he chose not to stand by Iranian oppressed people, Iranian innocent people, and to go ahead and ignore Iranian freedom fighters instead of to sit down with the Islamic regime and deal with them. I thought that President Obama understood the feeling of oppression by being an African American. I thought that the history of black slavery would make him sympathetic toward those people under oppression. I am really disappointed by his passive behavior toward Iranian people.
This is interesting that you bring up the issue of slavery. You're so very right that when Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson and killed, and obviously it was a case of self-defense, he ordered the Department of Justice to thoroughly investigate this whole situation. So you mentioned black slavery. You mentioned the rights of black people. It's very interesting you said that because he should be feeling the same for the Iranian people. And I like that you brought this up because it's a very good contrast. I think people want to connect with your brother, Nazreen. Before we go any further, let's focus in on Akbar and who he was and what he stood for. Tell us about him.
Sure. As you know, Randy, and you read his book, my brother Akbar was a student at Tehran University in 1996. In that date, Akbar, along with my other brother Manuchar, along with some other students in Tehran University, founded the first secular student society after the 1979 revolution. It was the first secular student movement. He was arrested in the infamous student rally held in Tehran on July 1999. And regime arrested him and took him to the dungeon of Evin and tortured him very badly. Both Akbar and Manuchar were arrested in on July 1999. They were taken to solitary confinement. We could not get any information about their whereabouts for more than 4 months. We didn't know are they alive or regime killed them. After 4 months, when we saw them for the first time, my mother could not recognize Akbar, because he lost a lot of weight due to torture.
Now,
it was very difficult to recognize him. And as we knew, and many students, almost most of the students and Iranian people are knowing him as a brave student freedom fighter, and also a symbol of student resistance for freedom and democracy. Akbar believed Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, and Martin Luther King. And he was a brave student. I am proud of him. if I'm missing him very badly, but I'm proud of him and his path.
You mentioned the people that he admired and looked up to, and you mentioned that when your mother had the opportunity to see him for the first time, she really couldn't recognize him. I think most of us have heard stories about the way political prisoners are treated in Iran. But when I read this book by Akbar, this prison diary, I could feel his pain. He described the kinds of torture administered by the interrogators, and one of the most gruesome ones that really affected me was they would take cables, steel cables, and beat the bottom of his bare feet and then hang him upside down. These were incredibly just inhumane tortures committed against your brothers. Isn't that right, Nazreen?
Yes, it is right. It's painful. Even I mention and talk about that. When I couldn't read my late brother's book more than two times because very painful, and every time my tears came out and I couldn't control myself. Because it's the worst torture Islamic regime gave to him, because he was very brave and a student resistance for democracy and freedom. And most of students, they knew this. He was very strong, and regime was afraid of him, and regime killed him. They buried by themselves, and after they buried him, they were afraid of his dead body more than a month. Two agents of regime were always from morning to night, night to morning, were standing on his grave because they were afraid of his dead body.
As I was reading Ideas and Lashes, which is the book you wrote that features Akbar's diary, I noticed that you made mention of how Akbar, even brutally beaten in prison, would still be so kind to other prisoners, would stand up for them, would be their voice, would help them financially. When your family was able to send money to Akbar in prison, he would share it with the other prisoners,
yes.
Wouldn't he?
Yes. Everybody knew, even those cellmates with him, now they are in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. They had interview by Persian media. They mentioned about this reality. And he wasn't just political and human rights activist. He was a man of peace. He was, very kind, and who had a rich heart and very humane.
As we think about what's going on with these nuclear talks, Nazreen, and you see your very president sitting down with terrorists, I think we need to really emphasize this. The Iranian regime is the state sponsor of terrorism all over the world. They're involved with Syria, Assad, Hezbollah. Everywhere you go, they funnel their money towards terrorism. So if there is a lessening of sanctions because of these talks, the money won't go to the Iranian people that are suffering. The money will be dedicated by the Iranian regime to the furtherance of terrorism. Isn't that true?
Yes, it's true. It's true.
What I want to do now is talk a little bit about your current situation with your mother. What is going on with your mother and father in Iran? What is the regime doing to them that we need to know about?
First, I want to tell you thank you so much. When, my parents were in very bad situation, you supported them, and you became a voice of them, and I appreciate it. And as you know, and it seems that killing my brother and breaking my family apart was not enough for the regime. They forbidden my parents to travel out of Iran indefinitely. They confiscated my parents' passport in the transit area of the Tehran airport. I must mentioned that my parents have obtained their green card from United States government in 2009, and they stayed with us in the United States for more than a year. They wanted to leave to visit my older brother and his wife and their grandchildren. And they stayed in Iran for 5 months, and after that, in February 2011, when they were returning from Iran, the Iranian government confiscated their passport at the Tehran airport. Two agents of regime came to them and insulted them, and after that, confiscated their passport and forbid them from leaving the country without any reason. What the any reason, what the problem is, or what they did wrong. There is nobody or no agencies to answer them or to tell them why they are not allowed to leave the country. Now it has been, I think, it has been 4 years that they have tried everything and asked all local and central authorities that what is that they did so they couldn't, they could deserve this. Why this regime doesn't allow them find anything? Unfortunately, nobody gives them any answer. Actually, all authorities denies that they had anything to do with this matter. We have tried all means which was available to us to in order to help this situation, but unfortunately, we could not do anything so far. My mother had a stroke, and you knew that, and you covered this news. She had a stroke a few months ago, and she went to coma. She was hospitalized for weeks, and eventually she came out of the coma. Now she's being treated at home in Iran. This happened to her after this stroke. I am really worried for their well-being. My parents need our help. They need our help for their daily activities. I have two brothers and a sister who are living in the United States. None of us is allowed to return to Iran. All of us are citizens. If we go back in Iran, they are going to arrest us and kill us. I want to say that the only way that we are able to help them and to taking care of them is to let them to come here to the United States. But they couldn't find and they couldn't get any answer. And regime still doesn't allow them. And they are like a home hostage and home arrest in Iran.
So in a sense, it's a house arrest against your parents because of your human rights activities, of course, and because of what your brother stood for. They put him under a house arrest and a travel ban. And as you mentioned, you had to go through a very painful time last June. I remember covering this story when your mother suffered a stroke. And we were able to, through the Cross in the Desert, send this program out to a lot of people that support you. A lot of prayers went out, and she did recover, and we're very thankful for that. But it's very painful. Now, Nazreen, as you look back at everything that has happened in your life, you're able to come here and live with your brother, but you can't be with your parents. It's still very, very painful. And then as you see the President of the United States sitting down and trying to have this dialogue and this framework of a nuclear treaty, it has to be the most painful thing since the death of your brother to watch the country that you love, to look at the president that stands for our freedom and rights, betray you.
Yes.
It has to be so hard to watch.
Yes. Yes. As we knew, the Orandi and the Mollah's regime has proven to not be worthy of trust. They don't know trust. They have treated the IEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, and nuclear weapon plenty already. They're lying every day. Islamic regime is being run by a bunch of liars and has two faces. This government cannot be trusted. They lie easily. And how President Obama trusts them? That is a very huge question for me. And I am very disappointed. I came to United States, and thanks God, thanks United States. This is my home. I belong to this country because I didn't have home in Iran. I wasn't safe in Iran. But I'm disappointed from President Obama. He knows, and everybody knows, Islamic regime came to negotiation table when her economy was collapsing. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would not have come to Lausanne, Switzerland. What is being said in that 5+1, we know, are 5 permanent members of the UN Security Council, 5+1, like United Kingdom, United States, Russia, China, and France, plus Germany. And Iran came to an understanding for a final agreement about the nuclear issue. They have not yet come to a real agreement about nuclear issue. It is not easy to talk about this agreement because from several interviews made by the Western and Iranian officials, there are many discrimination in their explanation. U.S. officials said, as we know and we heard about the news, that when Iranian come to an agreement and sign the agreement, the embargo will be temporarily suspended and it will be slowly lifted when Iranian show good evidence of a practical fulfillment of the agreement. But Iranian officials said that embargo will be immediately lifted as soon as agreement is reached and signed. And 5+1 believes that only Natanz, is the name of city of Iran, that they have a nuclear, and they said Natanz nuclear base will be operating after the agreement. But Iranian said that all nuclear base will be operating and no shutdown and so on. I am not, Durandi, I am not optimistic about the end result of this meeting. I think this is being done due to depletion of money from Iranian Treasury Department. Without money, this regime cannot control Iranian opposition. I think what West is doing is not in the interest of our people. It is a safe, shaky regime. Islamic regime is very weak.
Well, Nasrin, everything you said is absolutely true. It's all about economy. It's all about money. It's all about furthering their terrorism, and there is no way to really supervise them and to know what they're going to do. Instead of nuclear rights, Nasrin, we should be talking about the human rights of Iranian people.
Yes.
When we come to the table, we should address their behavior, their involvement in terrorism. We should tell them to stop saying death to America. We should tell them to stop saying we're going to annihilate Israel. We're not addressing their behavior. We're not addressing the human rights of Saeed Abedini and Amir Hikmati, who still sit in prison in Iran. There is no preconditions for their release. This is horrifying, and this is just unimaginable that your people, the ones that you speak for, are suffering, and the human rights are being ignored. It must be painful to know this.
Dear Randy, I want to mention this. You should weren't born this Islamic country of Iran, and you should feel it. I was born during Islamic regime of Iran. I felt, and I grew up in that country. I can talk many hours that there is no human rights in Iran. When you talk about Saeed Abedin, yes. Why? Washington Post reporter, who is an Iranian-American, Jason Rezaian, is in the Evin jail. Why? And he was being even denied to access an attorney. His brother is leading the fight for his freedom. We also have another prisoner who is an Iranian-American in the prison, Mr. Amir Hikmat. He came just in 2011, came to Iran to visiting his grandmother and his family. But regime took him into jail and blamed him as a CIA spy. And Pastor Saeed Abedini, because of religion, and they took him and he's in prison. Why? We don't have any freedom, any human rights in Iran. President Obama and many people, they knew. They knew about this. If there is a human, there is not any human rights in because Iran has the upper hand. The U.S. wants to shift policy towards Iran for help in stopping ISIS from making the U.S. victory in Iraq a loss to an Islamic caliphate. Islamic regime made, we know, internally and internationally crisis because this, since the beginning of revolution Iran up to now, Iran crisis after crisis and was born through the crisis. This regime has proven that she can only survive in the crisis. Crisis for regime like air to breathe. Internal situation of Iran, socially, politically, or economic-wise, has always been in crisis. They are unable to solve the Iranian affairs, execution, imprisonment, participation of the revolutionary guard in drug distribution, governments, corruption, and many more failures by this regime. And we know about this. And I think more than 70% of Iranians are under poverty line. But it's very rich country. Why we have more than 70% under poverty line? Prostitution and drug addiction is rising daily. Most of young people, they are in drug. They have a drug addict. The value of Iranian money has declined tremendously, and Iranian or our per capita is less than what was 36 years ago. That's very strange. Before 36 years ago, before the revolution, moral is fading and so on. Islamic regime is putting Iran sovereignty in jeopardy by interfering in the internal affairs of other countries like, as you said, Lebanon, Palestine, Sudan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. As we all know that this regime was imposed to Iranian people by the U.S. government. U.S. government during the President Carter. President Carter, a Democrat president, was demanding human rights for Iranian from the previous regime. He pushed the Shah to respect the human rights, open the society, and so on. Strange enough, Mr. Carter never talked about violation of the human rights in Iran under this Islamic regime. It seems that he does not read the news about Iran, and he doesn't care, and he doesn't know anything about Iran. The gift of Democrat President Carter to Iranian was a regime with more than 103,000 political execution, more than a million killed and injured in the war with Iraq, wasting of more than a trillion of Iranian people wealth, a bankrupt economy, a nation in poverty, a corrupt system of governing, a nation with losing ethic and morals, and in a dictatorship system with a belief of 15 centuries and many more. And now President Obama is putting his step exactly where President Carter did 36 years ago. Islamic regime is now on the weakest point of her lifetime. Western embargo has brought this regime to her knee. President Obama is that Iranian people want to see this new Democrat president to fulfill to promise that previous Democrat President Carter made to our nation, and that was human rights. I want to ask to my president, President Obama, if human rights wasn't violated this much in Iran, and there was freedom of choice and opinion, Iranian people would never go after atomic bomb. Never go after atomic bomb. They would elect a democratic government to run their country, not bunch of thugs, not bunch of killers. They are worse than Hitler, and they are killing every day. But President Obama cannot see it, cannot hear it.
Yes, and you bring up this point about Jimmy Carter, the president at the time of the Shah, abandoned the Shah at a time when the Shah needed his cooperation and help, and we have a similar president, President Obama, that is doing mostly the same thing to the Iranian people and appeasing the mullahs. I want to take this quick phone call. You got just a second. We have a listener, I think, that wants to ask a question. Welcome to the Cross in the Desert.
Am I live?
Can I help you? Yes,
you
are live. And your name?
Okay.
And what is your
name? My name's Claire.
What is your name?
Claire.
Claire. Hi, Claire.
I had a question for the lady. What is her name?
Her name is Nazreen Mohammadi. This is Claire Nazreen. Can you hear Claire
hello,
Nazreen?
Hello, Claire. Yes, this is Nazreen. Hello.
Well, I was wondering what you thought of the Shah's family that's remaining in the States, such as Darius Hillier, and his involvement with Carter and the regime back in the 70s, or if you had heard about him. I guess he's referred to as a prince, but...
What did she say? Sorry, I couldn't hear. Barely.
She wants to know about the Shah's remaining family that lives in the United States now, what you thought of them.
What do I think about them?
Yeah. Have you heard about some
they
of his family there?
They are victims. They just, they didn't have country. And their queen is living in Paris. Just sometimes she's coming to visit the prince in Washington, D.C. And they just are victim of Islamic regime of Iran, the victim of President Carter.
I would encourage you to look up Prince Darius Hillier, who is a grandson of the Shah, from the first wife. You know, there was two wives. And his involvement, it was just maybe you should take a look. I guess that's it. I thank you for letting me listen. Go ahead and put me on.
Okay, thank you, Claire, for calling. Thank you for asking
your
question. And that was about Darius. Are you familiar with Darius, a grandson of the Shah?
Darius?
Darius. She was mentioning a person's name, Darius. He's the grandson of the Shah.
No, I never heard about that name.
Okay. Well, that's all right, because there's a lot of family ties everywhere all over the world, and I think that she was trying to ask the question if you could research his involvement in what went on in the Islamic Revolution back in 1979. Prince Darius, and I'm not really sure I understand or know him either, Nazrin.
Well, I did and never heard that about that, because we knew Prince Wuza, I knew he had, but we never heard about his grandson, but he doesn't have a grandson. He has a granddaughter, but I never heard that. Might be, I don't know. Thank you so much.
That's okay.
Have any question, I want to tell you thank you so much for the time to say goodbye to you, and then I appreciate for the time you gave me.
Well, before you go, I wanted to just take just a moment, Nazrin, because you were talking about President Carter, you were talking about President Obama, and what has happened in these past 36 years, how the very American presidents that need to help the Iranian people have really failed them. And it must be grieving for you to remember back at the time when Carter was president, and it seems he didn't come to the aid of the Shah. And now we have President Obama, who's not really helping the Iranian people. Back in 2009, when there was the massive demonstration during the failed presidential elections, the outcry about the what happened in the presidential elections, they feared corruption. President Obama was just a new president then and didn't reach out to the Iranian people. And now when he has an opportunity to reach out to them, instead of reaching out to the Iranian people, he's appeasing the mullahs with this nuclear deal. And you were putting together a scenario how they need to focus in on human rights. And so this is what your brother stood for, and this is what he would love to see if he was alive, that an American president is standing up for the Iranian people.
Yes, and as we knew, when September 11 happened, he was at the Evin prison, he cried. And he said when Islamic regime were torturing him, he didn't want to cry because to make them happy. Even was very painful. But when September 11 happened, he cried for them, and he wrote a letter, and I published in here, and that caused him to regime torture him again. And he had a hope from American people and American government to be voice of student movement and voice of Iranian young people to support government. And do you remember, Randy, 5 years ago when the Green Movement happened, students were on the street and were chanting, and they had a wish to President Obama to support them. But President Obama, instead of supporting them, support the government. And they were chanting, and many times regime were shooting them. They were chanting, Obama, Obama, are you with us or with Mullah? And he
Wow.
He was, with Mullah, not with Iranian people, not Iranian young people, young student freedom activists. If European, West, and American government, my government, President Obama, instead of supporting Islamic government, support Iranian people, standing behind them, we can, hopefully, we can one day have a free country and secular government who the people choose their government by themselves.
Yes.
Not Islamic government, not a terrorist government.
Mm-hmm. You're
so
right.
Much.
And I wanted to end our time together and thank you for being passionate and reminding us what your people said, crying out for 6 years ago to Obama, are you with us or with the mullahs? And right now they feel like that Obama is siding with the mullahs. They feel the same way, I think. But, I wanted to end our time together on a very positive note. Your brother wrote an amazing, beautiful poem. And I wanted to quote this poem and just get your reaction to it, because we're all talking about a free democratic Iran someday, where there will be a freedom to choose, a freedom to wear what you want to wear, a freedom to believe. And your brother wrote something to give us hope. He wrote something near the end of his life to give us hope. He writes, "The light of injustice will not burn forever. If it burns one night, its fire will be extinguished tomorrow. How long will sorrow be the joy of my existence? Much sin has been committed in your name, O freedom. On the threshold of execution gallows, torture rack, and prison, they drink wine and raise their glasses in your name, O freedom. The dark nights are over, my friend, and we will see the dawn when the sun rises on the edge of freedom." What words of hope by your dear brother.
Thank you so much. I hope I want to say just one sentence. I hope we find real freedom and democracy in the whole world, not just to anyone, in the whole world, and save, in essence, people.
Amen. Amen. Well, Nazreen, thank you for sharing your passion. Thank you for sharing your dreams for hope and freedom for Iranians. My guest has been Nazreen Mohammadi, the author of a very powerful book, Ideas and Lashes, which is the prison diary of her late brother, Akbar Mohammadi. And Nazreen is also a human rights activist living here in Los Angeles, and she is also pursuing a degree in leadership. She'll be pursuing her PhD. So thank you, Nazreen, for coming on the Cross of the Desert this morning.
Thank you so much.
And as a free American, speaking your mind without fear.
Thank you so much. We are in the free country, and for freedom we can do anything legally, and we can have a free speech, and as a freedom activist and freedom fighter. Thank you so much, and God bless United States, and God bless you. Bye.
And God bless you, Nazreen. And you've been listening to Nazreen Mohammadi. She is my good friend. Her story about her brother is featured in my book, The Cross in the Desert, and I really appreciate her taking the time to stand for her country. As an Iranian American, she hasn't forgotten them, and it's very evident. One of my good friends on the internet, a real professional, a real expert on the Middle East, and a contributor at Fox News, is Lisa Daptari. And of course, she's been following this framework agreement. But prior to this agreement, she had some sobering words about the topic we've been talking about. Why has our government forgotten the Iranian people? Just a few days ago, she was on Fox News to talk about the framework agreement and to talk about the Iranian people. I want you to hear Lisa Daftari right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
Now to the efforts to hammer a nuke deal with Iran before tomorrow night's deadline. My next guest says Secretary Kerry and the U.S. are missing out on a big opportunity by not connecting with the Iranian people. Lisa Daftari is a journalist and Fox News contributor, and she joins me now live from L.A. Lisa, you wrote a stellar column where you talked about 75 million Iranians that are being left out of this whole negotiation. Why is it so important to engage the people in that country?
If we are really after curbing the Iranian regime, we have to go after their Achilles heel, and that's the people. And we have every reason to know that the Iranian regime is more concerned about domestic affairs than they are about the West and the nuke deal that's about to go forward. And we know this because the number of executions, the number of crackdowns, have almost doubled under this moderate President Rouhani than they were under Ahmadinejad.
Wow.
So we know that back at home, things are not so calm. They crack down on journalists, on dancers, on musicians, on anyone who is looking to express any kind of dissent or to do anything that is Western or to practice a religion that is not Shia Islam.
Well, how do you get to the people, though? Because we all remember a couple of years ago when there was an uprising, and many people believe that it was a major failed policy under this administration, that they didn't make more of it, and it exploded on Twitter. The people did have a voice for a short time before they were cracked down upon. How would that happen again now?
Right. So we already have the biggest part of the puzzle. That's the Iranian people, 75 million people strong, that are willing to come out into the street, that are willing to really brave it all to tell the world that they are smart and savvy and technologically able to really get their message out there. And how do we get there? Look, sanctions are the right path. And right, so you could say we already did sanctions, and all it did was really paralyze Iran's middle class while bringing the mullahs to the negotiating table. Mm. Sanctions were the right path, but we did not follow a policy that we wanted to lead to regime change. This administration had a policy wanting appeasement. So the sanctions were meant to bring a handshake at the end of the day. If we use sanctions in order to have daylight on the other side of that, meaning the Iranian people would accept the economic hardships if they knew that there was going to be significant change on the other side. Second, whether it's President Obama or the next president that comes into office, regardless of political party, there has to be a statement made to the Iranian people saying, we're going to stand behind you and we support you.
Well,
so they have every support behind them to come out onto the streets again.
I encourage people to look at your article, Lisa, because it was very interesting, and not a lot of people are talking about all the people who, by the way, are the most important part of that country. All right, Lisa, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Time to
of
check
course.
In with...
That's Lisa Jaftari from Fox News. What an amazing lady that she has such a heart for the Iranian people. She is Jewish in her background, Jewish-Iranian, in fact, and she has spoken out in favor of Israel, supporting them, and, of course, the Iranian people. I really appreciate Lisa because right after Rehana Jabari was executed, such a sad, sad story, back in October of last year, Lisa had the privilege of talking to Rehana's mother, Sholi Parkravan, and had a very emotional, very, very thought-provoking interview, and I'll never forget that. It really put a focus on the terrible tragedy of the death of Rehana Jabari, who was hung simply because she defended herself against a rapist by killing her rapist. And it was a very powerful interview. Lisa has focused in on Iran and has spoken very eloquently and very passionately about the Iranian people. And she's been on the forefront of this nuclear deal, and she has a lot of insights that I want to share with you. We've heard from Nazreen this morning from a personal point of view, talking about how the regime had tortured and murdered her brother several years ago, and how she felt betrayed by her president going to the bargaining table with a country that had killed her brother. But I want us to now go to the other side of that and look more carefully at this nuclear deal and the ramifications. Now, the deadline, again, has been extended to June, but this particular segment was just a few days before the framework came out publicly, and I want you to hear the insights that Lisa has about this. We need to understand this more and more each day so we know what we're dealing with. So I want you to hear Lisa Daftari talking about the nuclear deal right now on the cross in the desert. Let's listen.
Deal with Iran is being heralded as a historic moment. Iran's President Rouhani is saying it's the first step toward ending Iran's isolation and building a better relationship with the rest of the world. But that stands in contrast to remarks last month from Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, when he said Iran was negotiating solely on the nuclear deal, nothing else. Can nearly 40 years of bad blood between Washington and Tehran be erased with a deal that critics say is a terrible mistake in the first place? Let's bring in Lisa Daftari. She is a Mideast journalist and Fox News contributor. Good to see you, Lisa.
Good to see you.
Yeah, I want to start here. So there are optimistic comments from President Obama and Iranian President Rouhani. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister saying earlier on regional TV that, quote, differences will remain between the U.S. and Iran. So will the mistrust go unchanged?
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult to erase 36 years of history when this deal is so narrow in its scope. We'll be lucky if we get any type of change and any type of curbing of their nuclear program, if that. Now remember, the Iranians came to the negotiating table in order to have a visual moment, in order to come, shake hands, nice photograph, to declare victory, to have the sanctions removed, and just that. And at the same time, the narrative that's being sold here in the West is that we only have these two options, whether to go forward with a bad deal or no deal, whether to bomb Iran or let them get the bomb. And in fact, there is obviously a third option or a better option. We can have a good deal with Iran.
Which would look like what?
Look, at the core of it, this deal is meant to curb Iran's nuclear program. That means to dismantle the program, not to leave the Iranian regime at a threshold capability right around the corner from a bomb. Secondly, and most importantly, this deal does nothing to leverage any behavioral change from the regime. The bottom line, the West should be telling the Iranian regime, if you want to be normalized back into the international community, you have to act normal. You want to export oil, you have to stop exporting terrorism. That means they have to change their behavior in Syria, stop the bloodbath there, stop supporting the rebels in Yemen, stop taking advantage of the political vacuum in Iraq, stop supporting Hezbollah, Hamas, stop the awful human rights abuses back at home, and more importantly to us here in the U.S., release the three Americans and give us information.
And that's where I was going to go, Lisa, because you're saying they should change the behavior. Let me pull up a full screen right now. It brings me exactly to this. You've got three imprisoned Americans in Iran and one missing American, last seen in Iran about 8 years ago. If you showed these pictures, here we are, Saeed Abedini, Amir Hekmati, Jason Rezaian, and Robert Levison, who has been missing for 8 years. I mean, the question is, will Iran release these prisoners?
That's not been a part of this deal. And from the beginning, President Obama, Secretary Kerry said that they don't want to mix anything else with this deal. They don't want to bring up human rights, whether it's calling out the Iranians with their human rights back at home against women, against journalists, against other innocent individuals, or against the Americans that are being held there. We didn't want to mix these two, so we're not going to be seeing any behavioral change, and that's a huge mistake. When we have the Iranians coming to the negotiating table, before we lift these sanctions, we have to leverage any type of power that we have to see any significant change.
So you don't think that diplomacy is... there's absolutely no place for diplomacy when it comes to talking to Iran and trying to get them to reduce their enrichment capabilities and to ultimately stop them from getting a nuclear bomb.
Look, Iran came to the negotiating table because of the sanctions, because of the pressure back at home. The people want the sanctions lifted. I talk to hundreds of Iranians all the time, interviewing them, all types of Iranians, all over the political spectrum, all over the economic spectrum. They want the sanctions lifted. It's about the price of bread. It's about jobs. They want the sanctions lifted. They came to the negotiating table. Now that we have them here, of course we want them to curb their nuclear program. But at the same time, let's connect all the dots. Let's connect the activity that the Iranian regime has all over the map. It's not going to be solved with this one deal.
Right. So, Lisa, quickly, do you think that if, because the option to put the sanctions back and put the, you know, clamp back down on Iran with sanctions, that always is an option. Do you think if they don't come to the table come June 30th and really, you know, agree to whatever terms that they finally agree upon, that would even work to threaten them with reapplying those sanctions, if you will?
Once we open the floodgates, there are so many that are enthusiastic to do business with the Iranian regime, and rightfully so. Once we open those floodgates, it's going to be very, very difficult to apply the sanctions back on the Iranian regime. So while we have them, we have to strike while it's hot. We have to get whatever we can out of them. Again, there aren't just two options here. The third option is to have a good deal, and everyone across the globe, whether it's Israel, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., the allies, everyone will agree with a good deal if it will mean significant change from the Iranian regime.
But isn't that the big question? What is a good deal? I have to go. I'm not asking you to answer because I know you don't have that answer right now either. Lisa, not many people appear to. Exactly. Lisa Daftari, always good to talk to you. We'll see you again soon in New York.
Of course.
And we must remember all those Americans who are missing.
Lisa Daftari outlining just what needs to happen here. A curbing of their behavior, a limiting of them enriching the centrifuges, addressing human rights, which is not part of the negotiations, but it should be, and bringing home Saeed and Amir. My good friends are refugees. Iranian refugees suffer all over the world looking for a freedom that they don't have in Iran. They are in a country in limbo waiting for the UN to intervene in their refugee status and help them assimilate them to freedom. Some gain residency. My good friend Mir Nush waited 2.5 years in Sweden to gain her residency, and thankfully today she is free. She has a new home. Even though her heart breaks over the Iranian situation, she has a new home in Sweden. She can enjoy life again. She was once under such bondage and fear. But I have two wonderful friends, one I call my goddaughter. Her name is Payman A, and her good friend Hamid. I asked them to sit down and share their heart with you. Share their thoughts, their feelings about why this is a very bad deal and what is missing in this deal. And they took some time and they put down their thoughts and their questions. It's like a personal letter to President Obama, calling out to him and trying to reason with him. So what I want to do for the next few minutes is let you hear their heart in this special letter that they wrote to the president. Let's listen. Dear President Obama, for years and years, some Iranians put their hope in American presidents and powers in other countries to help them get rid of the Islamic regime of Iran. For years and years, another group warned them that the only hope is the Iranian people themselves. They did not expect any help. They did not expect any help, but they did not expect such powers to worsen things either. They did not expect those who wish a happy new year to the Iranian nation every year and separate the lovely nation from the dangerous movie suddenly make a decision for the nation, causing more problems for the nation by strengthening the government and their terrorist friends around the world. But many of them once had hope, and they are now disappointed. These are their questions. What guarantees are there to ensure you that the government who violates the human rights of their own nation can now suddenly establish the rights of the world? What caused you to believe, President Obama, that nuclear rights are needed to be discussed, but the human rights of the nations are being completely avoided? Should there really be a deal on nuclear rights when the problems of human rights are not addressed? Are nuclear rights as important as human rights for Iranians? The regime from Khomeini's time to now made hundreds of promises. All presidential candidates opened a new beautiful window of hope towards the people's eyes, making them vote. Before the revolution and after it, Khomeini and his friends made a lot of promises, but none of them kept their words. And it was obvious during the history of after the revolution in Iran. What has made you believe that they will keep their words in their agreement and honor what they promised? How can those who have been deceiving their own nation in four decades be trusted? Albert Einstein said, quote, "The world is a dangerous place to live, not because of the people who are evil, but because of the people who don't do anything about it," end quote. Mr. President, to tell you the truth, we agree with you. If the Islamic regime of Iran cheats, the world will find it out, but it will be too late. The world will find it out when they start to test their weapons and perhaps bombs. If they really cannot make nuclear bombs, what guarantees they might not easily make microbial and chemical weapons? President Obama, have you done the deal for the Persian nation? Do you think this agreement will help Iranian people or terrorists? Do you think the relief and sanction that is translated as cancellation will stop executions, free political prisoners, end child abuse because of poverty, and will send working children back to school? Will this agreement stop transmitting hazardous electrical waves sent to disturb satellites, preventing people from watching program broadcasted? Will it stop cancer, tsunami resulting from those waves, air pollution, and low-quality gasoline? Will it prevent the regime's guards from abusing women due to their hijab? Will the agreement solve unemployment issues in Iran, decreasing the rate of depression and suicide resulting from the regime's bad performance? Will this agreement stop the embezzlement of public funds? And will people's money be returned to them? Will it bring the murdered young women and men back to the families and make them alive once again? Mr. President Hussein Obama, what have you done? It gives false hope to some people who do not know what is waiting for them. for those who think now the country will be transformed into a paradise, those whose vital rights have been stolen, those who are ignored by you, those whom you have forgotten, those whose wealth has been stolen, and now the regime gives them very little portions of it for their absolute rights as a favor, and some really take it as a favor and are very thankful. Slaves who labor all the day and only are given a little food to survive and are very thankful for that food. The Iranian nation has been taught to be thankful for their stolen rights for long years and are used to this type of so-called Thanksgiving. But this nation does not need that little food. They need human rights, the very basic rights that you and me enjoy. They need the right to breathe, to have sufficient food, to have shelter like the Lebanese and the terrorists who are owing the Iranian regime by their own money. People in Iran need their absolute rights to be happy, to think their happy thoughts freely, to speak freely. They need the right of living. They need the right to live like a human being. If you put a frog in cold water and slowly heat the water to boil over time, the frog will be boiled to death. But if you plunge that same frog in boiling water, the frog will immediately jump out. And you, Mr. President Obama, you are helping the Islamic government in Iran to kill its own people. Alexander the Great said, quote, "I am not afraid of an army of lions led by a sheep. I am afraid of an army of sheep led by a lion." You might wait and see how this regime will harm your U.S. and put you and other peacekeeping countries in risk based on their everyday chance, death with America, down with Israel, down with this country, down with that nation, and in time it will be proved that Prime Minister Netanyahu was right. You have decided for, and instead of the nation who are facing gradual death and a lot of suffering beyond your imaginations, while you have your own life and happiness and do not experience what they are experiencing. By your decision, this oppressed nation will get more and more oppressed. The nation who can't even rise up and shout. This nation hoped you would help them restore what President Carter did to them 35 years ago that paved the way for the Islamic Revolution. Mr. President, my nation is desperate. They are dying from suffocation, struggling to breathe, and they feel hopeless. They are crying out for human rights while you negotiate for nuclear rights. Signed, Peymaneh Sabet and Hamid Derkakesh. Thank you, Peymaneh and Hamad, for sharing your heart on my radio program in this very personal letter to our President Obama. Well, we've been talking about the thing that's been neglected here, human rights. That what needs to be addressed. I want you to hear this brief little report on the real situation in Iran, Iran's human rights atrocities.
Nuclear apocalypse has narrowly been avoided. Iran has agreed to curb its nuclear activity. Now let's not get ahead of ourselves. It's not like Iran has suddenly leapfrogged the Nordic countries on the global democracy rankings. Iran is still the boogeyman of global politics. And it still presents grave foreign policy challenges to the West. Just look at the atrocious human rights record to see why. Now, pro-Iran groups will tell you that a new, more liberal president signals a renewed commitment to human rights. And President Rouhani did release some political prisoners. He did increase access to social media. And he has urged police leniency on violations of Islamic dress codes. But is this really anything more than supercilious tokenism? No. The human rights situation is still dire. Last year, there were over 700 executions. 5 million websites were blocked, including entries on safe sex and sexual health. 70 internet cafes were shut down. Journalists were issued with arrest warrants. And musicians need state approval just to produce albums or hold concerts. Iran's penal code views homosexual acts, alcohol consumption, and insulting Islamic prophets as some of the most serious crimes. It also allows for crucifixion, amputation, flogging and stoning. In one province, there was an amputation machine installed in a public square. Laws also allow a custodian to marry his adopted children if it is deemed to be in the best interests of the child. Several universities banned or limited female enrollment, and women need a male guardian's approval to get married. They also need his written permission just to travel outside of the country. And the argument that the international sanctions somehow foster the environment where these abuses could occur is ridiculous. There's no sanction that put an amputation machine in a public square. The fact is, Iran is still a country built on a radical religious ideology. Human rights violations are deeply embedded in law and state practice, meaning that sustainable reforms won't come quickly or easily. We need to do more to make sure that they come at all. World leaders focus on economic sanctions, Iran's links to Hamas and Hezbollah, and the supposed threats to Israel. Grassroots human rights are lost in the quagmire of international geostrategy. So maybe it's time that we changed our approach. With the nuclear issue sorted, maybe it's time that we refocused our attention, not on the threats to people in other countries, but to the threats facing the people within Iran.
And yes, that is the reason why the cross in the desert is here, to be a voice for the voiceless, those that are suffering within Iran, those that you don't hear about enough on the news. And last year at this time, speaking of human rights atrocities, there was a surprise raid in the very prison where Farshad Fathi, a Christian pastor, is being held. It was in Evin prison, and this was an atrocious day, just last Easter. And I want to play this clip for you. It's from a man who is the head now of Alam Ministries, Mr. David Yagnazar, and he is being interviewed. And I want to focus in on this because we're talking about the suffering of Iranians. We're talking about the treatment of Christians like Saeed Abedini and Amir Hikmati, and then also Farshad Fathi. I want you to hear what is going on as we talk about nuclear rights. We're not hearing enough about human rights. What happened last year was a horrible example of how prisoners are treated. Let's listen to this special report.
Joining us via video Skype is David Yagnazar of Elam Ministries. David, what can you tell us about this attack against Christian inmates at Iran's Evin prison?
There was over 30 inmates who were beaten when a group of guards came in and were doing some kind of inspection. And from what we understand, they were the prisoners were told to leave the cell while the inspection was going on, which is unusual. And then a disturbance began, and they were beaten very, very badly. Farshid Fathi, who has been in prison for 3 years, is a Christian prisoner, a wonderful man of God, actually went to assist one of the men who was hurt very badly in the incident. But when, as he went to assist him, he was attacked himself. He was he had sustained a broken foot. And what happened was while he had a broken foot for 3 days, he was not allowed to go to the hospital and receive any medical treatment. He was in agony. And finally, on Easter Sunday morning, they were able to give him get him to the hospital for some treatment.
Well, he must have been in excruciating pain. What is his family saying about this?
Well, his parents went to see him and said that it was one of the greatest, hardest times that they had seen him in these 3 years because of the agony that he went through. But Farshid wrote a very beautiful letter saying that it was an incredible moment for him because it was actually Easter Sunday morning that he finally went there to the hostel, and he was in this pain over the Easter weekend, and it gave him a very different view of the whole Easter story. And finally having some relief on the Sunday morning was great for him, but obviously a very trying time. But he wrote a beautiful letter of forgiveness for those who attacked, and again asked the Christian world to pray for the persecuted church, for those who are suffering, and not only Christians, but many who are suffering injustice in Iran.
David, how did the Iranian government respond to this? What is its responsibility in this incident?
Well, you know, I think there are really two different sides. There are hardliners who are trying to wash over the event, to defend what took place. But there are others who are very angry. First of all, the families of those who sustained injuries were very upset. There were demonstrations outside of Evin prison. It really has created a great debate within the system, which hopefully will lead to more justice in the country, and we pray for that. We understand that the head of the prison has lost his job in that situation. Mm. So there are two sides here. One side is trying to promote more freedom. Another side is really trying to come down hard. And again, it's important for Christians to pray that there will be just and fair rulers in Iran today.
Now, this wasn't that unusual. How are Christian prisoners usually treated in Iran?
Well, Christian prisoners have suffered. Obviously, there are many who have been imprisoned. There have been hundreds who have been imprisoned over the last 3 years under the previous president and still under the new president, Rouhani, who has promised a greater freedom and more leniency. In fact, promised to release prisoners, and nothing has really changed. So Christians have suffered, but it's not just Christians. If you talk to lawyers who've worked in the country, who've had to leave because they were under pressure, because they saw so much injustice in the system itself, that, you know, whether it's a Christian case or not Christian case, there's so much injustice. And we need to pray that, again, there would be more freedom for people to enjoy what the Bible says is right and just and fair.
That is David Yegnazar, who is the director of Alam Ministries to Iran, a wonderful organization that actually prints these wonderful prayer booklets that I give away at my book signings all the time, where you can spend 30 days praying for every aspect of Iran. Highly recommend Alam Ministries for their faithful work in training pastors, reaching out to Christians, producing videos, bringing the good news of Christ to the Iranian people, and specifically those Christians that are suffering inside of Iran. And you heard about this event from last year. I wanted to update you, and my point in playing this was to emphasize again that as we hear in the news and watch the nuclear framework and all of the discussions and negotiations, let's never forget the people that are suffering behind the Islamic curtain, behind the steel curtain, where there are no human rights and no freedom. And as I was thinking about Farshad Fathi in that segment, and he was received, I think it was a broken ankle, as a result of the guards beating and coming in and just the way they treat Christian prisoners, the tremendous cost of following Jesus. And Jesus had so much to say about this issue. I know today we talk an awful lot about reaching out to people with the good news, the unconditional love and grace of Christ, and that's all true, and every bit of it is 100% biblical, but I think we need to reemphasize what it will mean to be a disciple of Jesus. You know, Jesus said some very shocking things and that for our Western ears to understand. In fact, it sounds like that he was trying to talk many of the so-called people who wanted to follow him out of following him. But he's trying to be honest and lay down the guidelines. And in fact, in Luke's Gospel, chapter 14, verse 25, there was a large crowd following Jesus. And I can see this. These large crowds had probably seen some of the miracles. They were fascinated by his teachings on the Sermon on the Mount, his great words. But Jesus wanted to remind them, in the culture they lived in, what it would be like to follow him. He wanted to lay out the truth because there is great suffering in following Jesus, as we just heard in this segment about what happened in prison. And Jesus said, if you want to be my disciple, you must hate everyone else by comparison, your father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And if you would not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. Whoa! What do you mean, hate my father and mother? Are you meaning what I think? No. Jesus is saying, look, when it comes right down to it, your love has to be supreme for me because it's going to involve making decisions for the kingdom. And if you have a greater love for even your parents, and even your family, if you're more devoted, if you will, to them than me, then don't sign up. And of course, Jesus is making the point that our love has to be first for him. He is our first love. And if you're not willing to carry your cross, then you cannot be my disciple. And then he gives the illustration, but don't begin until you count the cost, for who would begin construction of building without first calculating the cost to see if there's enough money to finish it? Otherwise, you might complete only the foundation before running out of money, and then everyone would laugh at you. They would say, there's the person who started that building and couldn't afford to finish it. Or what king would go to war against another king without first sitting down with his counselors to discuss whether an army of 10,000 could defeat the 20,000 soldiers marching against him? And if he can't, he will send a delegation to discuss terms of peace while the enemy is still far away. So you cannot become my disciple without first giving up everything you own. He said this to the rich young ruler because the rich young ruler, his love was money. His love was reputation. His love was things and not Jesus. And so Jesus is saying some pretty unsettling things to our Western ears, but he's trying to be honest with us. There is a cost to being my disciple. And before you sign up, you better know what the terms and conditions are. And when I think of my Iranian friends, they truly know what the terms and conditions are. Unless you take up your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. I want you to hear Chris Tomlin from his latest CD, Love Ran Red, that talks about the cost, but talks about the great forgiveness and the great transformation that happens at the cross. Here's Chris Tomlin right now on the cross in the desert. Chris Tomlin, exalting in the cross. May I never boast but anything but in the cross of Christ. I care to know nothing among you but Jesus Christ and him crucified, Paul wrote. I'm thinking this morning of the cost of discipleship, the cross of Christ, and I'm thinking of Dietrich Bonhoeffer from his classic book, The Cost of Discipleship. Dietrich was a Lutheran pastor. He was a dual agent. He was a prophet, and he was a martyr, hung in 1945, right before the fall of Germany. He writes to us in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. Costly because it calls us to follow, and it is grace because it calls us to follow Jesus Christ. It is costly because it costs a man his life, and it is grace because it gives a man the only true life. It is costly because it condemns sin and grace, but because it justifies the sinner. Above all, it is costly because it cost God the life of his only Son. You were bought at a price, and what has cost God much cannot be cheap for us. Above all, it is grace because God did not reckon his Son too dear a price to pay for our life, but delivered him up for us. Costly grace is the incarnation of God. Dietrich Bonhoeffer from his book, The Cost of Discipleship. We have heard from Nazreen Mohammadi this morning, putting in perspective what's going on in the world today. Putting it in the proper perspective in that we need to be discerning and not trust this regime. When we sit down at the table with them, even though we're trying to open up this dialogue after 35 years, and even though we're trying to sit across the table from a nation that we have put sanctions on, we are, again, focusing on the wrong thing. Instead of saying to them, stop your behavior, stop your terroristic threats, stop your death to America, death to Israel threats, stop your terrorism, instead of addressing behavior, we are meeting them and appeasing them and becoming cozy with them and giving them billions of dollars in relief while they will continue to enrich their nuclear program. And instead of addressing the issue of freeing Saeed Abedini and Amir Hikmati, we have decided not to do that. And I can hear the cry of the Iranians from 2009. Are you with us, President Obama, or are you with the mullahs? Those are haunting words, haunting questions that we cannot forget. Whose side are you on? In the end, is this about your legacy, President Obama, or is it about the lives of Iranian people? Is it about opening this constructive dialogue to so-called avert a war, or is it addressing terrorism at its core and by saying to them, stop your activities if you want to talk with us at this table? Why? Why have we abandoned, once again, our people and the Iranian people? Why have we decided that we can trust mullahs who are destroying and oppressing their very own people? What is it about our country that we've lost the conviction of we are the greatest nation of freedom on the earth? We are the greatest nation that shouts, come here and you can have a new life and new dreams. We are the greatest nation. Why are we surrendering our convictions to a nation that's oppressing its own people and that's funding terrorism all over the world? It's a question that all of us have on our hearts and minds every day. And yet God says, come to me, pray, hear. I will hear your cries. I will hear your prayers. Our responsibility for the Iranian people and to pray for this nation. If we want to see change in leadership, if we want to see this nation become great again, it's only when we repent and come to God and ask him to heal our hearts and our ways. It only begins right in the kneeling position that we see the greatness of our nation again. We speak out, but we pray. We kneel before a holy God, and we repent, and we say to him, save us from our wicked ways and heal our land and our hearts, O God. It's only when we do that in the kneeling position that we will see change in this nation once again. We are to speak out like what I'm doing, and we are to pray. Those two go together. Those are powerful combinations that will shape history. To speak out, to be a voice for the voiceless, but pray and ask God to heal our land, to heal our nation, to restore us once again. I want to thank you so much, Mary and Vic and Vito and everyone, for joining me today on the Cross in the Desert. Please keep our nation and the Iranian people and Israel in your prayers continually. Your prayers are effectual and they are powerful. Thank you for joining me today on this very special program with Nazreen Mohammadi, my good human rights Iranian-American friend. And please, please, please keep our nation in prayer. God bless you all. We'll see you Monday again on the Cross in the Desert.
Great of wrath, our sword, he has loosed.